podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, John O'Bacon, and Leo Laporte. Episode 73 for June 13th, 2009, Tim O'Reilly. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show that covers free, libre, and open source software each and every week with our good friends, Mr. Randall Schwartz.
Hey, Leo. Good to see you.
Hey, hi, Randall.
Of Merlin, yes. And then there's John O'Bacon.
Hey.
On our left. And he's, of course, the community manager for Ubuntu and a regular on this show. And our great guest this week, Mr. Tim O'Reilly, who's in studio with us. And that is a thrill. Hi, Tim. It's nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Randall wants to talk about his T-shirt before we get too embedded in the conversation.
Right. So last week, on last week's show, I was really thrilled because in the mail, I got this package from our friend Laurie LeBeau Walsh.
Yep.
And I got this great shirt. It's a Floss shirt. And then you went to Art and Tech Tees to try to find it, and it wasn't there.
Yeah.
And if I had only dug down in the package a little bit further,
I would have
seen this letter that I didn't find until yesterday.
Oh, how 18th century.
That says that the real URL that you want to tell people about is twitstuffstore.com, all one word. And you should go there and check out all the wonderful TWiT t-shirts. There's many, many sizes, lots and lots of different designs. So it's actually really quite cool. So she's been doing that now and wanted to pass it along. She also says, I got to read this last paragraph because it'll also make sense. Enjoy and thanks for the plugs. Sales have really picked up. I always know when Leo is rerunning the Floss show, it will generate at least one new order each time.
Yay!
You are better than the ShamWow guy. So that's my new handle. I'm better than the ShamWow guy.
Wow, what a commendation.
But you're not made in Germany, I don't think.
No. So I'm thanking Laurie for the shirts.
He does absorb 20 times his weight in excess scotch.
There's no such thing as excess scotch.
Uh-huh, my point exactly. So okay. tell us, since both of you have actually worked for Tim O'Reilly, tell us who Tim O'Reilly is, Randall.
I can start by saying that I have known Tim now since 1991 in person. I think it's the first time we met.
That's right.
We had released the Camel book, Programming Perl, and we had the seminar in Dallas. Was it Lisa in Dallas?
Yeah, it could be. I think that was the time I showed up at this. It was one of those whirlwind trips, and I remember waking up in the morning, going out of the hotel. It was this really big hotel, and going, where am I?
That's when you know you've done too many appearances. What the hell town is this?
It was just like I just had completely forgotten and I had no idea where I was.
That's when you have to look at the stationery in the hotel room. I've done that way too much too. But yeah. So Mike's first experience of Tim is meeting him at a get together. I think after the first day, I don't think you even saw him during. No, it was the night before the conference because we got together. You had you and me and Larry Wall and a bunch of other people that were there representing various things about Lisa. And that's where I first met Tim. And he hasn't changed a bit. He looks just like he did 20 years
right.
ago.
And he still has the...
Actually, I don't know that story is accurate because I don't think I met Larry until 1997 when we did the first Perl conference.
No.
In face-to-face. Because Maybe I'm wrong.
I think you're wrong because I know Larry was at that party that you were at. And we sat next to you. He sat on one side of you and I sat on the other side, I think.
All right, well then, maybe I'm misremembering it. But we certainly worked together before we ever actually met in person.
Yes. And
we did, of course,
you from like the 3 years before that, as you were releasing these wonderful animal books, of which I am very happy to be a proud member of the family.
Which fill my shelves, I might add. Yeah. I mean, I have as many animal books as there are. I love them all. Mm-hmm. So Tim is known, of course, as the eponymous publisher. How do you say eponymous?
Eponymous.
Eponymous publisher of the O'Reilly books.
Yeah.
But also as a great thinker and I think a great philosopher in this new technology stuff, and you do a great many conferences now, the eTech and Web 2.0 and
open source convention open happening source. In San Jose this June.
When did you start doing the conference business? Was that
It was 1997. It started actually with the Pearl Conference. Yeah, and it was really triggered a little bit by two separate events. We published the second edition of Programming Pearl in 1996. And it was just a huge, huge bestseller. In fact, the computer book buyer at Borders, Carl Abea, told me that it had been one of the top 100 books in any category at Borders in 1996.
In any category?
In any category, right? So I
That's mind-boggling.
Yeah, it was mind-boggling. And it suddenly just struck me as, how weird is it that there's no mention of Pearl in the computer trade press? You know, because there was no corporate sponsor, there was no... And so that was one... factor. And then at the same time, there was this Microsoft ad campaign on television for ActiveX, where it was all about activate the internet. And Andrew Schulman, who was working for me at the time, the guy who wrote unauthorized, Windows 95 and undocumented DOS and those things, he actually said to me, said, you know, Tim, in that commercial, all those sort of active internet things they're showing were all done with Pearl, except for that little animated taxi cab that goes across the screen.
Yeah.
And I was just, you know, kind of pissed off. And I said, I got to do something to raise the profile of Pearl. And then I, you know, Java 1 had come out and I went, wait a minute, we should do a conference for Pearl. And it was really to raise the profile of Pearl. And then the next year I went, holy cow, all of my bestsellers are about open source things. So I kind of organized the meeting that we came to be called the Open Source Summit, because that's where we all voted on names and agreed on it. But it was originally called the Freeware Summit. And then, of course, we expanded the Pearl Conference into the Open Source Convention the year after that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now you've got many conferences, you've got many businesses, you've really expanded out. You're on Twitter, where you put links every day, great links. What is your favorite venue for talking to people these days? Is it online or is it at conferences?
It's hard for me to say I have a favorite anything.
But you're in constant conversation with the world out there.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly, Twitter is the biggest... sort of change in my conversational mix.
Many of us, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I certainly still spend a lot of time doing things on email as well, in person.
You're such an advocate of open technologies. Does it concern you that Twitter is anything but open?
You know, yes and no. I think I like to think I have a more nuanced view of open than a lot of people. Purists will say, oh, you know, he's a traitor. You know, he doesn't. But here's the thing. From the very beginning of my advocacy about open source, I've really just been interested in having interesting things happen in the world. And the reason I liked open source and worked on this idea of renaming it from free software to open source was because I don't think it's a religious issue. Hmm. It's really about how do we actually encourage and spark innovation? Because for me, a more interesting world is where there's more innovation and more freedom to innovate. Mm-hmm. And I actually always had a strong disagreement with the Free Software Foundation, which sort of saw it as a religious issue. I was always much more in the Berkeley camp, you know, which is, you know, as Kirk McCusick once summarized it, he said, Richard Stallman came along and said, there's this evil thing called copyright, so we need copyleft. And we at Berkeley, we just said, take it down to Copy Central and copy it.
That's what Kinko's is for.
Yeah. So I kind of grew up in, you know, with, you know, my models were, you know, the X Window system, which was really the same Berkeley model. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the web came along and, oh my God, it's even more open than that. It's public domain. And the idea that people could build on it, you know, you give it away because you want other people to do things with it that you can't do or don't want to do. I wrote a little essay for Nature Online back, many years ago, in which I compared Larry Wall, the author of Pearl, to Bill Gates. And I said, they actually both have the same goal, but different means. They actually want to make their software available to as many people as possible. Bill Gates came up with the strategy of doing it, you know, by commercializing.
I got to point out, he's got a fatter wallet too.
Well, he does, absolutely. But, you know, but I said, look, they both want to make their work more valuable. And Larry looked at his options and he came up with the idea that giving it away was a more viable strategy for him than trying to commercialize it. And he had a great impact as a result.
It's altruistic somewhat, though.
Yes and no. But when I remember talking to Larry about it, and he didn't see it really as altruistic so much as he saw it as a different kind of commercial transaction. He said, look, I got so much benefit from all the free software that I received that I felt like this is how I paid back and kept the...
Right.
So, mm-hmm. you know, we forget that, you know, money is a, you know, is a technique. It's a hack that got out of control in some ways, you know, and we've forgotten that, you know, money is a signifier of a more fundamental exchange. And, you know, open source kind of just went back to, you know, and free software just went back to, hey, you know, let's make it available. And this early recognition that the free market, so-called, of capitalism is not the only way to exchange goods.
Well, what's the currency of open source?
I think the currency is, well, first of all, there's a huge currency in reputation.
Yes.
No question. Yes. And that is, in fact, how most open source you know, developers have, you know, monetized, if you will, their, you know, giving things away free.
And Randall's a good example.
Yeah,
I mean, Randall's built a huge reputation. Jono, too, built huge reputation.
And we also see this in, you know, has migrated from software into other kinds of intellectual property, musicians, you know, or even look at something I did, you know, and this is where we start to get away from open source. Like I put out this paper, What is Web 2.0, right? I basically, it's up, you know, freely available on the web. I don't remember what the licensing is on the original copy, but it's, you know, CC attribution in many incarnations since.
I might, by the way, I'm going to interject here, congratulate you.
Yeah.
Because at 10:22 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, the 1,000,000th word in the English language was added. Did you see that?
I saw that. Although a lot of purists said,
It's not a word. Web 2.0 was declared the 1,000,000th word in the English language.
A little bit of marketing on their part. I'm sure that it wasn't just by chance that they picked that. But I will say this, you know, to all the language purists, you know, words are pointers.
Right.
Right. And, you know, and it
if you took
like,
the space out, it's still Web 2.0.
That's right. You know, and I kind of think about it this way, is it's not absolutely a word, but that's a little bit like saying, you know, well, you know, we only accept, you know, 1-byte pointers or something, you know.
Right. Anyway, I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool.
How do you
too.
Define Web 2.0 since we're talking to the man?
Well, Web 2.0 for me is a broad term for the internet as platform and in the study of the rules of sort of business and competitive advantage on that platform, and in particular, what those are. It really goes back to open source.
How is Web 1.0 not that, though?
This is where it all gets very, very complicated. First of all, I didn't coin the term Web 2.0. Dale Dougherty did. Dale's worked with me for years. Right. He was the guy behind GNN.
I remember him selling internet in a box at internet.
That's right.
Conference.
You know, first web portal, first commercial site on the web, and so on. But Dale's original thesis was that it really came out of a brainstorming session with Craig Klein about a possible partnership conference between us and what's now TechWeb. And it was just like, what could we do a conference together on? And Dale said, everybody thinks the dot-com bust means the web is over as a business model. Right. We think there's a lot of innovation still happening.
Right.
So Web 2.0 was really the second coming of the web. It has nothing to do with the version number.
Like a phoenix rising from the ashes.
That's right. Yeah. But I immediately realized that that was a great term because Dale was, his you know, idea was, hey, what distinguishes the companies that survived the dot-com bust from those that... that failed? And I said, oh yeah, well that fits the narrative I've been developing really since 1997 with my first talk on open source, which was that it was about understanding the network as platform and what that meant. So to understand all this, you really have to go back to open source and in some sense the dialogue that I have been having with the open source community since the very beginning of my advocacy about it. The very first talk I gave on the subject of open source was called Hardware, Software, and Infoware. I've since published it, a paper version of it, or a written out version of it. But I actually gave that at the Linux Congress in Würzburg in 97, the same conference where Eric Raymond first delivered the Cathedral and the Bazaar. And, what I said was effectively that the web was the thing that everybody in open source needed to be paying attention to, not Linux. And, I said the web is the killer app of open source. I opened the talk by just pointing out that a friend of mine had actually said she went out and bought a computer so she could use Amazon. And, and I said, and you'll notice that even though Amazon is built on top of Linux, Amazon is not.
It's not open.
It's not open. Yep. And I went from there. It kind of developed the narrative over the next couple of years. I eventually wrote a paper called The Open Source Paradigm Shift. And it was really focused on trying to get people to think about how the landscape of the computer industry was changing. And I opened this. It was a talk. Like a lot of these things, it's a talk, and then I eventually write it down as a paper. But the talk always began with the question, how many of you in the audience use Linux? And I get a show of hands. And then I would
ask... That's a trick question. I know where you're going.
Well, everybody does now, but even today, you can still catch people with it. Yep. And then I would say, okay, how many of you use Google? And then every hand in the room would go up. And I said, you guys just told me that you're still locked into this idea that what you use is the machine on your desk. And that's changing. Mm. And this kind of goes back. I had this debate with Richard Stallman in 1999 at a conference in Berlin called the Wizards of OS. And I made the point that, the whole regime under which free software and open source had come into being was under fundamental attack, not by the forces of evil proprietary software, but by the architecture of the systems we were developing. And the example I used was, it was Google. I said, Richard, if Google gave you their source code, you would not be able to run it. It's not just source code. It's a set of business processes. It's a set of data. You wouldn't have enough machines. You wouldn't have enough capabilities. And Richard's response in 1999 was, it doesn't matter because it's not on my machine. And I was like, man, you're really going to get bitten by this because the world we're building is this world of the internet as a platform. So as I developed that and thought more about it, and particularly once we started the Web 2.0 name and we launched that conference and I was trying to put more meat on that, I was really asking that question, what does distinguish that next level of software? And as part of this, there was a wonderful piece that I wrote that I read by Dave Stutz, who was a guy who was behind some open source efforts at Microsoft. And when he left Microsoft, he wrote this wonderful little essay. I think it was called "On Leaving Microsoft."
I remember
and
that.
And in it, he talked about software commoditization, and ended with this wonderful line: "There's plenty of money to be made building software above the level of a single device," which is where I got that line. And when he brought in that notion of commoditization of software, it was like everything fell into place. And that was when I was really able to tell the story the way that it needed to be told. And that was, and this kind of goes back to my original Hardware, Software, and Infoware. It was really a meditation on what could we learn from the IBM PC. And what we learned was that when hardware became a commodity using off-the-shelf parts, software became valuable. And the real secret of the open source story was that, and the real consequence, which everybody in open source needed to be aware of and think about, was that open source was commoditizing, and open protocols on the internet was commoditizing software.
In the same way that software the PC got commoditized.
The PC commoditized hardware. Yeah, that's right. Yep. So we had that analogy. And by that same analogy, then something else was going to become valuable.
Mm-hmm. And what is it?
And that's where I came to this connection with Web 2.0, that it was actually, it was about databases that grow through user contribution.
Very interesting. That's Twitter.
Twitter. Anything. So that's the heart. So you asked what's Web 2.0. It's network effect driven databases is the heart of the network as platform. Now, let me give you a very concrete example of this. The Google mobile app. And this is where the internet as platform and these sort of user-generated databases come together. So you take out your iPhone and you, let's say you've got the Google mobile app installed. I mean, there's a lot of really cool things about this, but you know, first of all, there's all the sensor stuff. You pick it up and it knows immediately that you're in speech recognition mode, assuming you're in the Google mobile app to begin with. So just from the motion. So that's very cool. That's sort of, but that's local, and it also
knows where you are.
Yeah, exactly. But you think about what's happening here. I say pizza, and the speech recognition is not being done on the phone.
Right.
It's being done in the cloud.
Right.
Well, how did Google get the data to be able to do good speech recognition? They actually put out this service called Goog 411.
Right.
And I immediately blogged that on Radar saying,
did you know what the point was?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, that's really interesting.
I wrote Google wants to get into the speech recognition business, and they're starting to build the database.
So collect the information.
About it. So they got enough from there. And this is why Microsoft, not understanding Web 2.0, bought Nuance, right?
Right.
They said, I mean, not bought Nuance, bought Tell Me, the number two player. Nuance, it was the number one player in the space. Google said, wait, we actually think we have enough of a plausible promise that we can kind of build this ourselves, and it'll just naturally get better as people use it. And so they leapfrogged Nuance, who wanted to do a deal with them.
Mm.
And so they started this. They built up enough of a plausible promise. So then think about what's happening. First of all, so there's this cloud database, which is a subsystem of the internet operating system, speech recognition. And then it's coordinating with this other subsystem, Google's original one, search. Because, of course, they can do better speech recognition because they know what you're likely to be searching for.
Mm-hmm.
This is what Nuance does, too. They're in a doctor's office. They have context. And then, of course, they know where you are from the sensor in the phone. So then there's a third cloud database mapping the location. So all these three things, and you say pizza, they know that you mean pizza and not pizza.
Right.
And they know that you
unless
want
you're
the
in
three,
Italy.
The three lo- yeah, they yeah. know that you want the three local pizza places,
right.
And that's what they give
you. Brilliant.
And you think about it, that's the model of the future. And it really is about effectively these subsystems, if you like, of the future internet operating system are data subsystems. So that kind of comes back to the world that I felt like the open source community was missing. Not that they necessarily have to get it, but you have to understand the whole context of free and open source software. It's not about Linux taking over the world and replacing Windows. That might even happen, just like the PC replaced the mainframe. But it doesn't, and in fact, it probably will happen, but it doesn't change the dynamic, which, Clayton Christensen.
Winning the race after it was long over, really.
Right. Clayton Christensen, about the same time as I wrote the open source paradigm shift, he wrote this wonderful HBR, Harvard Business Review paper, in which he called this the law of conservation of attractive profits. When something becomes modular and commoditized, something else becomes valuable.
Right.
And that's really the heart of the of how we need to understand free and open source software in the context of what's happening in Web 2.0.
Right.
We can have as much open source software as we want, but we've now created this new layer where these databases that grow through user contribution are the real source of lock-in. So,
absolutely. So you look at Facebook, you look at Twitter.
Yeah. And so
you look at Google.
Eventually, these guys probably will make their software open source because it won't matter because it literally will
be. That's not where the value lies.
Yeah, the value lies in having the data. So the real question is, well, will there be a future open source movement that's really an open data movement saying.
It seems like that's where we should go, especially as the people who are creating this data and creating this value and not particularly profiting from the value.
Yeah.
I mean, we're giving Google all this value.
Well, and I don't know that we can avoid it, because...
Well, I look at Twitter. I mean, I think Twitter is the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
And as the parts, as part of the parts, I kind of resent a little bit the fact that we're pumping this value into this database.
I don't know.
We get the value out in terms of the usefulness of it.
Yeah.
Doesn't bother you?
It doesn't bother me because you do get the value out. Yeah. And you look at Google.
We get the value. I'll tell you why it bugs me. We get the value out, but only to the degree that Twitter allows us. So if they decide to turn off IM as they have, they can. They're titrating it. They're turning out.
I understand that, and it's not to say that there aren't real issues, with the power that is accruing to a Google or a Twitter or a Facebook. But I also think that I've always felt that open source is science, not religion, And
it's pragmatic.
It's pragmatic. And the answer is, if you close things off, eventually you lose. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why one of my slogans is this phrase, create more value than you capture. And as long as people are doing that, I don't care whether they, you know, they're trying to capture some value. I've been on the receiving end of that. The purists who say, oh, all O'Reilly books should be free. You know, Richard Stallman used to beat me up around that all the time. Right. In fact, as I go, well, you know, a lot of those books would never have been produced if they had to be free, you know? And so you take your choice. I'm into what mechanisms, what tools, what techniques can we use to create maximum value for society? And the market is one of those things. Giving things away is one of those things. We figure out which one to use when. You know,
Jono, did you want to?
Oh yeah, you guys. I've been talking. So
no,
long.
No, I just want to make sure because it's unfortunate because they're on Skype. Tim and I are in the studio. For those who aren't watching,
let me let you back off.
They get a little bit left behind. So we're going to give them.
It's fine. The thing I think is really interesting about what you're talking about, Tim. And the thing which I'm curious to know the answer to is one of the benefits that we have right now with an open source operating system is the fact that any component of that operating system, somebody can essentially take and they can improve and change. And the mechanisms and the tools required for that collaboration are clearly published. You know, since patch and diff were invented, people have been able to collaborate with software.
Yeah.
The thing that concerns me a little bit, and I entirely agree with you that it's, we should be talking about value, we should be talking about science, we shouldn't be talking about religion. The thing that concerns me about what you're saying is that, as Leo suggested, is that, for example, Twitter will provide this fundamental resource. This, you know, it'd be the equivalent of the scheduler in a kernel.
Yeah.
And if it's closed, and if, well, it's not so much it being closed, but if Twitter are the arbiter of how that will be structured, then that will fundamentally limit what we can do with the internet operating system. And I'm curious about how we build collaboration. I don't think there's anything wrong with having silos of information on the internet, but I'm curious about how we could work with people like Twitter and Facebook to build collaboration around those silos so they can work better together.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I think that this whole social graph area is going to be open. I'm so mindful of the parallels in the cacophony of non-interoperable social networks today. In 1994, I published a book. I forget how you would pronounce the title. It was sort of bang, splat, at something or other, a directory of email addressing and networks. And it had something like 150 or 170.
MCI mail.
Yeah.
CompuServe,
all these incompatible email networks.
Yeah.
And eventually somebody won.
It was very much like this.
Yeah, it was very much like this. And it didn't
work really until there was a common email standard.
That's right. And it just...
Same thing with instant messenger,
the force of the marketplace was... Yeah, IM hadn't sort of ramified quite as much.
Right.
But so I think we'll get to a point where, it will have to work together.
Does Google, with things like Open Social, does Google have the right way attitude towards unifying this?
You know,
they've been very open. Look how open Wave is.
Yeah, I think Google understands in a fairly fundamental way that they've got to keep the game going. By contributing back. Keeping, you know, and again, I think
their business is advertising. They don't have to make money on the software.
That's right. And everybody makes different choices, and they're going to make wrong choices. You know, there are definitely areas, and they'll bring in new people who don't get the internet culture and the free and open source culture as well, and they'll make different choices as a business. You know, we see some of this, for example, in the Google book search area, where they brought in a bunch of people from publishing who don't have that kind of DNA,
right.
And so it's been kind of a fight to get them moving in.
It's ironic. Microsoft had the most open of the solutions in the book business.
Yeah, but Microsoft didn't have the commitment.
No, they killed it.
See, I mean, I have to say that one of the things, this kind of goes back to my values, which is admiring people who are driven by the value of creating a richer world. And I think Google in that area really was motivated by solving a problem and creating value for the culture. And that, that matters more to me than that it's totally open. You know, I'd much rather have something that, you know, has a big impact and that is just open enough.
But do you think from that perspective, on one hand, I mean, I agree with you again that value is what we should be driving towards. It's in the same way that with, for example, with free culture, it's more interesting to me to have really great free music than to talk about licensing all the time.
Yeah,
that's the really interesting focus. But do you think that there's maybe a slight risk in the fact that if we focus on value too much, we essentially rebuild the proprietary world that we've sought to get away from?
Yes and no. I mean, I guess I look at it as, how is there enough value for other people in the ecosystem? There's always a risk that somebody will get you by the short hairs. You know, we saw this even with various, nominally open source players, you know, and eventually somebody has to go do a fork, or they have to work around it or whatever. You know, we're seeing the MySQL being a great example now, you know, and we're going to see this playing out. And certainly the right to fork is certainly a very powerful part of open source.
You can't fork databases.
But it's very hard to fork the network effect. And I'm not quite sure how we'll work around that. But I think there's an open enough mindset. Now, I think, you know, Twitter's being held to a very high standard when you think about the amount of
they've created something
of value that they have created for all kinds of other people by, you know. And I think another great example is Apple. I mean, Apple, you know, certainly more than Twitter, a very controlling
hugely
company.
Hugely closed platform, really.
Hugely closed, but open enough that people have figured out how to really, build on what they've done. And for that matter, Microsoft in its early days was also open enough. The problem comes when you get to a certain stage of your existence and you've created a whole lot of value, and then you start eating your children. You know, so Microsoft hit that point, in the 90s, where the only way they could keep growing was to kill their developer community and absorb it. And they ran out of gas that way.
So,
and
well,
I think we may see that with Google. And the way that we'll see it is when they start competing, you know, with the people who they gave birth to.
It seems as well that when people talk about these topics, it's very binary, the discussion. It's, as you said, Tim, you know, it's either kind of religious obsession, or it's either entirely open or it's entirely proprietary. And I think the most interesting discussion is going to be how we can make use of these big chunks of value, but how we can collaborate. Like, to me, it's I don't really have, personally, I really have an issue with Twitter being that source of value. I think what's really exciting is how we have access to that data. So, you know, things through APIs and that kind of stuff. And I'm curious as to how it's going to play out. Like, somebody who's conceivably a great citizen on the internet, if Twitter was a great citizen and people had access to the data in interesting ways, I don't think anyone would really have a problem. And it seems like the religious kind of side of things is kind of like paranoia that Twitter are going to screw us.
Something's happening right now with identity that I think is very interesting with Facebook. And the vanity pages.
Yeah.
It looks like Facebook, Twitter, Google with Google profiles are all asserting that they want to own the namespace.
Yeah.
Which is really taking it to another level.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, that's something I remember kind of starting to highlight quite a while back, was this idea that namespaces are one way that you, leverage.
Lock in.
Yeah. Lock in. And really one of the first Web 2.0 examples of that. In fact, probably the very first web service, if you think about it, was the DNS. And that was a namespace lock-in play. Mm-hmm. And that was one of my early examples in open source of how this happened. The business model got separated from the free software because people didn't understand that it was about the data, and the registry for the data was where the money was going to be made, not in the software. And it turned out to be a fairly substantial business. And because we didn't understand the future, that monopoly literally got handed over. I mean, the government paid them to take a monopoly position, and then it went, oh my God,
what have we done?
Yeah, what have we done? And then it was sort of all this stuff to try to unwind it and create competition. And I think there are going to be other cases like that where we have to think enough about where are these databases going, and what are going to be some of these namespaces, if you like,
And well, what are the next ones?
Well, I think identity is definitely a big one.
Yeah, we're there
location
now.
Is a huge one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening in location, and I don't know who's going to kind of win there. There's sort of a lot of complexity.
Interesting database. I was just reading on.
Yeah.
You have huge amount of location information from every single cell. Everybody has a cell phone now.
Yeah, that's right.
There is a huge amount of valuable data in this location information.
Yeah, where
who captures
are people?
It?
Where are people? When?
What are the hot clubs? What are the hot restaurants?
Yeah.
Where, you know, this is hugely
just
valuable.
At the beginning of that. And the fact is, in the beginning stages, there's often lots of competition, and you really can't see who's going to be the one who ends up consolidating it. You know, so for example, you look at, a couple of years ago, everybody said, oh, it looks like Facebook is going to be the social operating system. And now, oh, wait, maybe it's Twitter. You
right,
know?
Right.
And
it moves way too fast for us
and
to
So what we can identify is that there will be, this social subsystem. It may be, if we're lucky, be open. Now, that does not necessarily mean that it's going to be Laconica based and open source, as the purists have, but what it may mean is that, we'll have to figure out what does a real sort of registry look like, because I have to say, the DNS didn't really get it right in one sense. It was really just a land grab and whoever got there first. And now we have all these separate land grabs where you can go, okay, can I get my my name on service X, just in case. You're going to have domain squatting, effectively all that kind of stuff happening again. We already have it on Twitter. Why is it the real Shaq? Because somebody else pretended they were Shaq first.
Can that kind of ferment destroy the value in something like this? Can it be so fragmented that it can never achieve a network effect?
No, I don't think so. I think actually there's going to be a really interesting opportunity around in some sense, disambiguation. I think Wikipedia has done a good job
That's
of that.
That's right. You get
you get those disambiguation pages. Yep. You go search for Tim O'Reilly. There's actually three of us who've made it into Wikipedia. And it says, do you mean Tim O'Reilly, the Australian rock musician, or Tim O'Reilly? I forget who the other one.
Yes.
And I go, that's cool. And this actually fits in a really nice way think about Google. One of the great innovations in search is that they don't give you one result. It's not just Google. It's whoever first came up with that. It's like they give you 10.
Right.
You go, hey, is one of these 10 the one you might be looking for? And we need to have more of that. When we look for a person, we need to go, oh, yeah, we're going to get a list.
Yeah.
And the other
thing
I find that's tough about things like Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, a friend feed is that as soon as I hear about one of them, I've got to rush to make sure I've got my name there. But more makes me a little more angry is that I have to rebuild and reintroduce my social network to yet another location. So I can't just say, I'll be the same friends with the same 72 people here that I am on Facebook. You can't do that. Your social graph is locked in.
Well, I think all that's going to go away. If I have a prediction about all this, it is that the whole friend model of mutual agreement, we're going to, acknowledge each other as friends, is going to die. It's going to be almost completely replaced by the Twitter or Flickr style follow model, because that's really how the real world works. I mean, it's not like we, every once in a while, we get married, we have, people who were really, we say, we're really part of a club together, whatever, but we don't actually, we build friendship through a set of sort of repeated asymmetric contacts.
Right.
And I think that what's going to happen is we're going to get better at algorithmically figuring out who are our real friends out of all of the people that we have these social interactions with.
So you don't see a pub sub kind
of
structure?
No, I really think it's going to be much more, autonomic, where the system learns who our friends are.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And I just think we're going to get there. So I think we'll see that the follow model be adopted much more widely. And then you're going to have mechanisms. I just was talking with a startup this morning about, for example, group forming. It's right now it's really broken and stupid. It's like I see this person, add them to a group, in a Twitter client. I go, no, I want to basically take, for example, take the list of people who've been to Foo Camp and drop them on the service and say, make me a group out of this.
Right.
Go find them. And they'll come
and maybe
back.
Friends of friends as well.
I'm always thinking about Larry. Remember Larry's original configure program, Larry Wallace configure program? It would kind of root around and say, I'm thinking that maybe, you know, this is your configuration. Does this look right? I'm kind of thinking, suppose you kind of dropped your address book, you know, and first of all, you want a smart address book that, of course, learned everything from your email contacts, because the same thing there, you know, and your phone calls.
Gmail and Google Voice seem to be doing that pretty well with my contact book.
Exactly. So they start that list is starting to get smarter. Yeah. And now you think you drop that on the social network and then it says, hey, you know, there's actually three Leo Laportes. I don't know if there are, but, you know, is this the one you mean? Or is it this one?
Right.
You know, and that's a lot better than having to build it up bottom up.
Right.
Yep, definitely.
You face that, Merlin, because there are many Merlins. Some spell them the same, some spell them the same. And that's the other thing. It's not going to be names necessarily. Yeah. It's going to be handles.
Yeah.
We have all sorts of namespace issues. Yeah. It's a big issue. This is an issue we face with Laconica and Federation on Laconica. Yeah. Well, what if I have one name on Identica and another name on my server? How do we resolve these?
That's one of the things that sort of I haven't quite figured out with Open Social and all that stuff. Brad Fitzpatrick's original idea was this site that he called elsewhere.im, elsewhere I'm. And I just thought it was great. It was just a registry of all of your, and FriendFeed has kind of done that, you know, where that you kind of build a registry of all your different identities. But that's really what you want. You want to basically have a lookup service.
Right.
And in some ways, it's a little bit like a multi-value DNS.
I'm using Google Profiles for that. I mean, I wish it surfaced better in the Google search. It doesn't. But.
Yeah, I actually think, I mean, for me at least, what we've started doing is thinking of a person's Twitter homepages as their primary identity.
I hate to give Twitter that much power, but that's exactly what it is. That's what's happening.
So it's because it's usually they have some a short bio, they've got a link to their
people are doing
homepage.
That at conferences. They're putting their Twitter, they're turning around their nameplate and putting at Tim O'Reilly.
Exactly. And that's one of those things that says, oh, they're winning.
Yeah.
And the question, you know, Facebook is sort of opening up their namespace in, a couple of days.
But it's reactive, not...
And I think, you know, it may be too little too late. It's hard to say. I mean, obviously, Facebook has an awful lot of users.
Right.
So, Tim, I have a quick question for you. One thing I've noticed personally as I've really got into Twitter and Identica is the fact that I'm blogging less.
Yeah.
You know,
new blog.
It's, you know, when I can say it in 140 characters, then it saves me having to say it in 1,400 words. How do you feel like these changes in technology are affecting content production? Do you see that kind of effect happening, you know, across the internet and Facebook and Twitter changing the way that people are providing content and their desire to provide different types of content?
Well, you know, it is kind of ironic that people see it as somehow killing blogging. It's a form of blogging.
Right.
And the fact is, if you go back to Dave Weiner's early Userland posts, a lot of them were like...
It was a link list.
It was a Twitter stream.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Dave would write these longer posts from time to time, but, you know, you could argue, and Dave probably will, that, you know, he invented Twitter, you know, back...
I'm sure he said that somewhere,
You know, back, you know, however long ago it was he was doing that Userland stuff, because you look at it, it was like typically a one-liner, you know, saw this, check out this interesting link, but, you know, a lot of what we do on Twitter. Now, but that doesn't mean that there isn't room for longer form postings as well. And I found, you know, I stopped blogging, you know, almost exclusively doing Twitter, and now I'm coming back to blogging. You also see these hybrid forms. You know, if you look at the Huffington Post, for example, one of the things that they're doing is a kind of it's a little bit like God, I'm having a brain fart here. New York short blog Tumblr. You know, they're sort of really Tumblr-sized entries. You know, when you're on that HuffPo page and you see that little short squib, which, by the way, was probably invented by the Wall Street Journal, who used to have that nice column, you know, with all the little headlines of their stories, you know, in the print edition. You know, you got a short paragraph, which is longer than a tweet, and points often, sometimes it's to a HuffPo story, but often you'll click through and you go, oh, I'm on the New York Times. So it's this...
Herb Kane used to call that three-dot journalism.
Yeah, three-dot journalism. That's a great term. And, you know, Nat Torkington's doing that on our radar blog. He has these four short links posts every day, which is just a great way.
It's just what I want.
They're a little more than a tweet.
Right.
And actually, we've actually got somebody on my staff working on, they're going to take my tweet stream and turn it into something like that. We're actually thinking of twitting Bill O'Reilly and calling it the O'Reilly Vector.
Come and get me, Bill O.
Because you sometimes want a bit more than than just the tweet.
Sometimes Twitter can be very cryptic. It'd be nice not to have that, you know.
And so I think we're going to see the range of all these possibilities. Kind of going back to Pearl, Randall. You know, of course, the Pearl slogan. There's more than one way to do it.
Tim Twat. How do you pronounce that? Tim Twatwati.
Yeah. Tim Toady.
Tim Toady.
Tim Toady.
The impression I get, as well, as it in many ways, it's kind of in a strange way, it's bringing blogging back to, in many ways, what a lot of people envisaged it to be, you know, kind of like well thought out, kind of considered articles.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm as guilty as anybody else for just blogging just little bits of kind of unnecessary rubbish, whereas that will be more acceptable on Twitter, where people will post links on Twitter. But one of the things I love about Twitter is a thought will come to them and they'll just throw it out there. And they'll share that thought with other people. And in some ways, maybe it's bringing...
Simultaneously the joy and the pain of Twitter, frankly.
You know, with all this, it's really good to look at ecological analogies. You know, you think about how an ecology evolves. Say, after a volcano evolves, you know, you wiped out all of the... seemingly wiped out all of the life forms. You got this rock, and yet something starts to grow and gradually breaks down the soil, and then you get more complex, bigger plants coming in eventually, you know, you get back a forest.
Right.
This idea of ecological succession happens in media as well, you know, and we're seeing things get richer. The ecosystem is getting fuller. There are more types of expression online and more ways to monetize this. And that's one reason why I don't really worry about, you know, so the death of newspapers or, for that matter, the death of book publishing. Now, it may be really tough for some of us in the transition, but the job will get done.
Yeah.
And we just, it'll get reinvented in interesting new ways.
We're on the verge, it seems to me, of a creative explosion. What's really become a problem is that everybody's creating content. There's no monopoly of production. There's no monopoly of content.
I don't know. I guess I find
nothing
that,
wrong with that.
No,
I think it's great.
I find that a little overstated. Everybody has always been creating content. You know, it's just,
they just didn't publish it.
Yeah. Well, maybe they even did. I mean, you know, you think about the range of content. You know, it used to be PTA newsletter on an old mimeograph machine. You know, there were a lot of ways that people...
Even the back fence was publishing.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
I mean, the fact is, you know, you think about, I remember back in when I was in high school, you know, there was a print shop, you know, as part of the school activities. Sure. And we printed a school newspaper.
You bet.
You know, that was like a blog for the school. It came out every week. And, you know, it was old paper-based, and there was a mimeograph machine, and the school, you know, and you think about blogs, there are many blogs that have very small focus readers. There are many people who are tweeting, very small focus group of readers. This is no different. You know,
what Clay Shirky said, though, that we were in a passive, a lot of people were passive content consumers.
And they aren't now?
I think, you know, that's what's interesting about Facebook. It's participatory media. You can't just go to Facebook and consume
it. I would bet that there is still, you know, if you look
at the vast majority.
I would bet that the power law of, you know, the thing they've always talked about with Usenet, you know, the ratio of lurkers to is just as great on Facebook. I mean, hey, come on. Look, how many people have commented on our conversation today? You have something like... you're
a few hundred, maybe.
Yeah, a few hundred. Yeah. And you have thousands of people in the group.
Yeah.
So you got maybe 10% of them actually contributing right here.
Right.
You know, and
in fact, that's what we just saw. There was somebody who did statistics on Twitter, and it's exactly the number.
Yeah. And
it's
so I think that this, and I would lay odds that it's not very different from past media. And it's just really interesting. If you look at the history of media, how much. History, you know, recapitulates. So actually, this is not really relevant to this conversation, but it's just so cool that I have to share it. I just recently was listening to Walter Isaacson's biography of Benjamin Franklin. It turned out, you know, Benjamin Franklin was a sort of a heavy astroturfer. He ran newspapers And part of his, and he was a very competitive guy, and he would write all these letters to his own newspaper trashing the competition, you know, under assumed names. He would, it was just really, really cool. I was like, whoa, you know, nothing new under the sun.
Ben, we hardly knew you.
Yeah.
So much for founding father.
Yeah, really.
Hey, Tim, I'm wondering, though, with all this conversation going on, with all this, the new ways of publishing and new ways of getting things, what I'm finding, you know, over my 20 years of being in the modern computer world is that there's a lot more signal, but it's also raising the level of noise. And I'm having a lot harder time sorting out the things that I find interesting, things I don't find interesting. I mean, 20 years ago, you would go buy a copy of the Camel book and sit down in front of it, and that would sort of be the only thing occupying your time for the, you know, few hours that you were dealing with it. Now it's like, okay, I've got an instant message popping up over here, and I'm trying to watch this IRC chat and all that stuff. How do you see information flow from the people that have knowledge and are creating things to the people that need that as a consumer without it going all to hell because it's too much noise?
I don't know. First of all, that sounds like an opportunity to me for inventing some new tools. But I also think we've lost some things and we've gained some things. You know, you think about the ease of finding information that you need. You know, you think about how you Google for something routinely and you just find it. You kind of assume that you can get information about something on the spot. You know, it was just amazing when I was coming here. You know, you're looking at Google Maps, and I'm going, "Oh my God, there's a picture of every intersection I want to go to." And you know,
we actually thought somebody might actually be able to put a hood on and use Street View to navigate and walk around town.
You're not kidding me, because actually, when people ask me what do I think is the future, UI, I think it is a heads-up display.
Yeah,
I think absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to be wearing glasses. You know, with a heads-up display.
Do I know you, Laban?
augmented reality. Yeah. I totally buy that, and I don't think it's as far off as we think.
Wow.
And so I just kind of feel like we have to. We always lose something. Remember the wonderful opening of Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, where the guy in Borneo is saying, "How come you guys have all the stuff? You're so stupid." You know, I mean, he says, "I'd take you into the jungle and you'd be dead in 3 days. You don't know anything." And yet so we obviously, learned something that, you know, these guys in Borneo didn't learn. And I think in a similar way, there are going to be skills that are lost. I mean, my gosh, you know, they used to be able to recite the Iliad. You know,
Morse code. You don't have to know Morse code anymore.
Yeah. You know, so I think we are going to forget stuff and we are going to lose stuff. And this thing's going to be a lot harder. And then there's going to be other things that are a lot easier. And we'll build a new culture as a result.
I think it's one thing that's really interesting is the way editorial recommendations has kind of been now connected to people as opposed to publications. So I know a lot of people who get their news via Twitter by following some specific.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but I will make this point that you start as an individual and you become a brand. I mean, look at blogging. You know, it started out was all individuals. Now almost all of the top blogs mm-hmm. are publishing mm-hmm. companies. Mm-hmm. You know, and yes, there's a personality behind it, but hey, William Randolph Hearst was a personality. You know, a lot of the big newspapers were built by personalities. Again, going back to Ben Franklin, he was a personality and he, you know, built his newspaper empire, you know, back in the 1700s in the same way that Mike Arrington's building his empire today, you know, or Leo Laporte. And I guess I would just say, don't mistake a stage in the evolution of a medium for its end state.
I agree. Yeah.
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 Yeah. But fundamentally, though, there's evolution is going to go on for a long time.
Yeah.
So surely every stage, surely it's always going to be a stage.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, and humans are don't have the best ability to gauge change. We have a very linear point of view.
Yeah.
And clearly this is not a linear change. It's an exponential change we're in the middle of. Yeah. Tim O'Reilly has been at the forefront of it. He's the O'Reilly behind O'Reilly Publishing, but
it's called O'Reilly Media. It's it's never been called O'Reilly
Publishing. I like that. That's a very
it used to be called O'Reilly and Associates, and then it became O'Reilly Media.
A key distinction.
Yeah.
There's no publishing involved.
Yeah.
I have to ask though, when you were able to come up with the name radaroreilly.com, did you have to Were you planning that ahead of time? I mean, that someday you'd have to have that site, I imagine.
No, it was really, it was just one of these, you know, nice things, of course. you know, talking a little bit about sort of trend spotting, of course, suggests radar. And then, of course, that suggests radar O'Reilly, the guy who always got what you needed before you knew you needed it.
Yeah.
And that really is, I think, our positioning. You know, if it is kind of an odd sight in some ways because, you know, unlike people like TechCrunch or Mashable who cover today's news, you know, we like to think we're covering tomorrow's news.
Yeah.
You know, so you look at, you know, and so as a result, we often, you know, are doing these stories and people don't quite get it. And then, you know, a few years later, they're going, oh, you know, so again, you know, going back to that speech recognition, you know, I call that if a year later, Google says, yeah, that's why we're doing it. And then a year later, they introduce the next generation of apps. You know, we've been covering sensors, for years, you know, because we see, you know, all these geeks playing with sensors and we say, oh, sensors are happening, a happening thing. And now, you know, just the other day, The Economist is covering it. Well, right. You know, you could have read about it, two or three years ago on radar. And really, I started doing that because of my experience evangelizing open source and other ideas like that, or for that matter, Web 2.0, which I started, you know, talking about the internet as platform in 2001. And everybody was like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And, open source, it was, I had to remember having this conversation, in 97, 98, wasn't even calling it open source yet. Actually, I guess that one was in 98 after we'd come up with the name. Talking with Bob Metcalf, who was running a conference called Agenda. And I said, you really ought to cover open source. And he came up to me at the end of the conference, said, you were right, I should have covered it. He covered it the next year, you know. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, talking to people like IDC, and they said, oh, our customers aren't asking about it yet. And I go, what kind of research firm doesn't talk about this stuff till the customers are asking about it?
It's a little passive.
And so we just really thought, hey, let's try to give people an early warning sign of technologies that are going to matter. So, you know, if you look at what we're doing with Make Magazine today and, you know, Maker Faire week before last,
huge success.
70,000 people, you know, they're all telling us that there's this new hardware DIY movement happening. And we're having a hell of a time getting sponsors because it's pre-commercial still. You know, it's like they don't get that this is the next big thing. And, but whatever, we have fun. And eventually they'll catch up with us.
They'll come around.
Yeah.
Tim, it's so great to meet you and have you in here. I really appreciate you.
Thanks for having me. It's fun.
Jono and Randall, you didn't have much to say this time. I don't know why you were so quiet, but
sorry, I kind of going at it here and gave you a chance to get a word in edgewise.
Doesn't matter. When we have Tim O'Reilly in studio, I think we all three should just shut up and listen.
It seems to be working well for me. Leo, you had some great questions for Tim, so I just shut up. You were doing good.
Well, it was great to have you, Tim, and great to talk to you guys. We'll be back next week with more open source great stuff on Floss Weekly. We'll see you then, everybody.